Sometimes I can smell them. Rain and salt and cigarettes and something else, curiously, like cucumber, when I step out of the shower. Out of a sense of delicacy, perhaps. He has never appeared to me in the bathroom, but whenever I smell him, I dress myself slowly, making sure to hold in my stomach. I wring my hair and whip it back from my face. I clean the mirror of steam and stretch and strike a few casual poses in front of it. I lather lotion onto my body, first my legs, one foot up on the sink at a time, then my stomach, smoothing in the cream in small circles, and then my arms, and last of all, my breath. I dress at a leisurely pace, pulling my underpants up and sliding into them with a swivel of the hips, snapping on a bra with all the strut and reluctance of a striptease. I may have spent most of my life in New Jersey, but the blood of a geisha courses through me yet. When I first saw Philip, he was only a flicker in the corner of my eyes, gone even before I turned. Only gradually did he become bolder, moving out of the dusty corners to reveal his full form in quick flashes. Now he will stay in one place for hours. If I am reading, I can look up at odd moments and he will be there, watching me. Often he will remain with me until I finish the book. He is fond of small spaces, lazy as ever and cured, apparently, of his wanderlust. He likes crouching in a fetal position under my desk, and he enjoys folding his long body into an improbably tiny package so he can fit into the fireplace, along with a violet moth. Less frequently, he peeks out from behind the door, where he stands picturesquely shrouded by the curtains. Every once in a while, he lies on his side with his head propped up by an elbow. One day, as I was reading, I reached for my iced tea and saw into the clear glass of the coffee table, his face pressed right up against it, and his eyes peering out at me as if I were a goldfish in an upside-down bowl. He is always naked, he hardly ever moves, and his expression never changes. Even his eyes are still. Although I cannot control the time or the frequency of his visits, I still like him like this, silent and anonymous with my left hand. Behind the cover of my book, I rub my thumb against the tips of the other fingers, feeling the shell-like hardness. I spread my hand open and look at it, palm up. In public, I keep my secret clenched inside, and when I lie in Eric's arms at night, I am careful to hold my fist against my breast so that I fall asleep hugging it to myself. But when I think of Philip, I like to feel my hand and gloat over the smoothness where the fingerprints used to be. Maybe the lesson is that, in the end, you can't fuck genes. In my family, being haunted by a lost love is not even you. I come from a line of women with a tenacious grip on the men in their lives. Kiki, are you listening to me? Kiki. I look down at my novel, in which I had long ago lost my place, and then back up at Eric. I'm sorry, I tell him. I didn't hear you. What did you say? His eyes go round for a second, and I can tell he's holding his breath in as he does during sex. An unhealthy habit, which I need to tell him about at some point. Then he lets his breath out in an explosive laugh. I don't know if I can say it again, he begins. It was kind of a spontaneous thing. He kneels beside me. Why? With his trick knee. So that his head is for once at a lower level than my own. His face is unexpectedly close to mine, and as he shakes his head, still laughing a little, his hair lightly brushes my shoulder. Eric has brown silky hair and fine dark eyes, and his face, like his penis, is long and lean and intelligent. His knees are white and skinny with disappointment, but he is handsome and elegant, and his arms and shoulders are well developed. If he stood next to Philip, he would even seem husky. His fingers are small and they are not much to look at when they are motionless, but when they move, they twitch with an odd grace of their own. When I read, I use my fingers only to turn the page or occasionally push back my hair. When Eric reads, he takes copious notes in the margin, even on a newspaper, underlining and scribbling until his fingers are cramped and his words outnumber those on the page. He can simultaneously crack two eggs, one in each hand, without getting his fingers messy and without spilling bits of shell into the bowl, and even in his sleep he remains active, wrapping my hair around and around his fingers, until I cannot go to the bathroom in the middle of the night because we are literally chained together. What if, I begin, but I am interrupted by a tapping at the window. I turn around half expecting to see Philip, yet it is only a fly banging against the glass. Just a second, I say. I walk to the back of the room and open the window to let it out. The fly leaves and the heat and the smell of the city come pouring in, and I feel sticky where the outer air has touched me. You should cover yourself before standing in front of the window, says Eric, still on his knees beside the couch, all but clucking his tongue. They're all naked out there, too, I tell him reassuringly, a fact that can be verified by a glance into the windows across the street. But that does not necessarily alleviate the problem of flying eyes. Still, my rejoinder has its desired effect, for he nods, his lecture forestalled, or with any luck, forgotten completely. Even with the air conditioner on, the heat is such that we made the decision to shuck our clothing for the day. I wear underwear only, without a bra, and he wears boxers, and for some reason, a trace of shyness, a hangover from his prim childhood, socks. The heat is so uncomfortable, though, so much so that I cannot bear the pressure of my wristwatch with its dainty weight of gold, and I remove it, exposing a neat line of untanned skin flanked by two rows of sweat. As I turn away from the window, I stub my foot against a growing stack of Eric's discarded newspapers, and a couple of moths fly out, startled, from the pages of the Wall Street Journal. I have seen few moths in the apartment within the past year. In the coolness of the air-conditioned room lit by hazy sunshine, in spite of the life and the color that they bring, the flitting of the moth seems a slightly sinister warning, an omen invoking not the future, but the past. I love them. A year and a half ago, my apartment was infested with ants, and though they were harmless scavengers while the moths nibble holes in the wool blanket on the sofa, I hated the ants and loved the moth. Fragile and vulnerable, the moths make me feel as if I'm living in a land of butterflies and scorpions, of love and cholera, where beauty and danger feed on each other. Eric warns me that the moths will eventually eat up all my sweaters, but I cannot bear to get rid of them. After all, there's something both noble and pathetic in the moths' love affair with light. And even if Eric refuses to admit it, the ones in my apartment are especially lovely, unusually large and flecked with bits of blue-green that turn into violet when they fly. There are moments when they actually gleam, luminescent, in the half-dark of the evening. If I squint or if I'm not wearing my contact lenses, they look like stunted, blundering butterflies, and late at night, if I wave my book at them as they flop against the wall near the light, they rise and fly away together like dust, perhaps, or dreams. Eric has not moved from his vigil by the sofa. His knee must not be so bad today. I am just sitting down again when the ring of the phone makes me jump. Oh, not again, I say. The telephone is at Eric's elbow, but he does not even turn to look at it. But I can tell from some shift in his posture that he has to restrain himself from doing so. Only a few months ago, he used to answer my phone freely. I stand back up, stretch over him, and reach for the receiver. I speak into the phone, and there it is again. A whirring sound so high-pitched it makes my teeth ache. I shiver, suddenly wishing that I kept my clothes on. I put the receiver down, sit back on the couch, and look at Eric, who's scratching the inside of his wrist with some attention. Usually full of unsolicited advice, he does not like to discuss these phone calls. When I ask, he tells me that he doesn't think I should call the police, despite the fact that I've been receiving these calls now for almost 2 months. Don't you think, I begin, but looking up from his forearm, Eric interrupts. Will you marry me? The words come out in a rush, so fast that at first I think I misunderstood. His face is flushed, his hair tussled, and he's clad only in boxers and socks. Scant evidence here of the confident young lawyer who wooed me out of mourning. His gaze, so direct, bright and eager as a child, unsettles me, and I drop my own onto the floor. He has a hole in the heel of his left sock. I had not noticed it before, but with him kneeling, the bottoms of his feet sticking out behind him, no one could possibly miss it. A good portion of his heel is showing through the hole, and the whiteness of his skin makes a striking contrast with the dark blue of his sock. that his right sock looks brand new. Suddenly I realize that Eric must secretly favor his left leg with his problem knee when he walks, and I chalk up yet another question from my grandmother, one more to add to the list I have been compiling for her arrival. Did my rich and powerful grandfather, in whose presence the world cowered and bowed very low, secretly wreak havoc upon his footwear with his limp? And did she, too, want to swallow both a laugh and a lump in her throat when she saw how ridiculous was his exposed patch of heel? "You've been on your knees, your bad knees, this whole time, waiting to propose?" I say aloud. "It's killing me," he says, not a bit sheepish, if anything bad. "Come sit down," I say, patting the spot on the couch beside me. "I can't think, knowing you're in pain." The bones of his knee click loudly as he straightens it, and he clambers to his feet with a measure of awkwardness. Taking a seat at a decorous distance from me, he says, "I know it hasn't been long, just a year and a bit, but I'm sure," he says. He pauses, and then he adds, in a voice so low I have to stoop to hear, "I'll always love you, you know. Scout's honor." This whisper is so unlike his usual confident tone that I'm struck with the strangeness of the scene. This is not the proposal I would have expected from him, for who would ever have guessed that Eric Lowenson would kneel in front of a woman clad only in her underwear and pledge eternal devotion with one foot exposing a worn sock and two fingers upheld in a child-hung vow? He, the man who loves to stage meticulously planned pleasures. One evening, a fine silver bracelet presented with a flourish on the top of Empire State Building. And another afternoon, my birthday. A bottle of wine along with two glasses hidden behind a bush and miraculously still there when we went rowing in Central Park. The only thing he forgot that afternoon was a corkscrew, a disastrous omission, as he cut his finger so badly when he broke open the bottle that I ended up turning 26 in the emergency room. "No ring," he says, mistaking the reason for my glance at his empty hand. "Sorry, this really was a spur-of-the-moment thing." I shrug. "You do know, don't you, that I haven't forgotten Philip," I say. "I know, but you're almost there, right?" he says, and then answers his own question for me. "So it's not a big deal." "And your family? After all, I know they're upset about me not being Jewish, and there's the Japanese thing. Also, my grandmother's coming soon, and she's, well, you know." "Don't be silly," he says with some relief on firmer ground here. "My family's going to have to like it, and once they meet you, they will like it because they'll like you. And as for your grandmother," waving away the monumental presence of the past with one clean sweep of his hand, he continues, "she's just an old lady. She hasn't been a geisha now for what, half a century?" I nod absentmindedly, troubled, as I so often am with Eric, by a feeling that I am in the wrong story. As if I were a glass, Eric sees in me a future that mirrors his own. It is a world in which moths eat sweaters, bills are paid on time, and things are no more than what they seem, a place in which my grandmother, stripped of her geisha past, emerges looking gray, shriveled, harmless. What Eric will give me is a reason not to wait and watch by the window. What he offers is a band of gold that anchors me to earth, a talisman to prohibit old love, no matter how dear, from coming back from the dead. He sees in me a future that I myself could never see, but then again, my sight never has been very good. "Okay," I say, "thank you. It'd be good to marry you." For the second time today, his eyes grow round, startled, even thrown off balance. I struggled physically to maintain his smile for a moment, and I think, belatedly, that I spoke too simply and too soon, a girl accepting the offer of an ice cream cone, a stroll in the park, an umbrella held over her in the rain. Eric quickly scratches at his arm again, troubled as well, perhaps, by a sense that I am not a part of his story. But the moment passes, and soon we are kissing on the crackling, tearing pages of his newspaper, my novel tossed to the floor. "Grandmother?" I will ask. "Obasima?" "When my grandfather tendered you his far less reputable proposal, did you, too, feel inside you the silence of a house in mourning? Or were you able to blot out the memory of the eyes of your secret lover? Were you so happy that you walked away from your geisha home without a backward glance?
That's great. Thank you.